Okay. Let's see here. perfect. I hiked on peyote. I live on peyote, marijuana, morphine, and cocaine. I never knew sadness, but only a menace that burns at the heart and the brain. I see each charwoman, ecstatic, inhuman, angelic, demonic, divine. Each wagon a dragon, each beer mug a flagon that brims with ambrosial wine. I went to the city and found it a pity the devil was playing at hell. And 10 million mortals had entered hell's portals and thought they were all doing well. I said see dear people on every church steeple, an imp of the devil at play. See ghouls cut their capers in daily newspapers and fiends in police courts hold sway. The mountains are palaces, women are chalices, meant to be something not sold. The desert a banquet hall, set for a festival, ripe for the free and the bold. The wind and the sky are as heaven and all its stars, waken and do what you will. Break with this team and spawn hell-inspired nightmare bond, magic lives over the hill. They said I was crazy, ambiguous, lazy, disgusting, fantastic, obscene. So I hide from my sagebrush and cactus and cornbush to see if the air was still clean. Oh, I hiked on peyote, I live on peyote, marijuana, morphine, and cocaine. And may I be twice stand for a bank clerk or store hand if I visit the city again. Ooh. Hello, everyone. I am Jason Dingus. Welcome to Lost Rhetoric, a dim space for light hearts where we discuss all manner of odd. I'm sure you're wondering what that intro was. That I guess it was a rap. It's the first time I've ever rapped in my life. That was a poem by Jack Parsons called I hike Don Quixote, I live on peyote, and you might be wondering why I decided to recite that at the top of the show. Well, Jack Parsons is the subject of tonight's episode, and joining me is Grace Bigler. She's back. You might remember her from episode 8 about the Nazca Lines in Peru. It's been a while. She's a great old friend. I'm glad she's here with me. We will be getting into Jack Parsons here in a little while, but there's some stuff to talk about first. But yeah, I hope you enjoyed that recital of mine. I couldn't get it out of my head, and I woke up this morning as I had to record it. I had to, and it turned out okay. So, you know, fuck it. There it is at the top of the show. Let's get into last week's episode. If you didn't listen last week, do yourself a favor, go back, check out episode 36 with Jesse Gee about the Oak Island money pit and treasure hunting in general. We go over some personal silly stories and we talk about some wild Los Angeles treasure hunting excursions. But all in all, great episode. Go back, give it a listen. I would really appreciate it if you did. Who listened to that episode the most? Let's get into the top five. Coming in at number five, Columbus, Ohio. Welcome, Columbus. I think it's your first time. Really appreciate it. Number four, Stevenson Ranch, California. Also, I think, newbies to the top five. Thank you, Stevenson Ranch. Number three, hanging in the top five here, Richmond, Virginia. Thank you, Richmond. I think you were number one last week. Number two, Beaverton, Oregon. Really? Man, you guys have been real strong here in the last month or so. So thank you, Beaverton, for listening. And number one, Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thank you, Santa Fe. Makes sense. Jesse's from Santa Fe. Got a lot of friends out there. I went to school. We both went to school in Santa Fe. It makes sense that people in Santa Fe listen to that episode, I guess. So thank you, Santa Fe. Now that that's out of the way, let's talk shop. How do you get in touch with a fellow like me? Well, Instagram, of course. Find me at Lost Rhetoric Podcast. Follow my page. That's the only social media I have. It's the only way I reach out to folks. I don't have Twitter. I don't have Facebook. So if you have Instagram, follow at Lost Rhetoric Podcast. I would really appreciate it. And write me. Send me a message on Instagram as well. You can write me at lostrhetoricpodcast@gmail.com. I threw an invite a couple weeks ago where I asked listeners if they felt so inclined to write questions to me about anything, absolutely anything. And I will address these questions in the intro. And part of it was to prove that you guys aren't all robots. Like, when I get these numbers for the top five, sometimes I'm skeptical. I don't know if they're real people or if they're whatever, some fucking robots. But, you know, I am slightly disappointed because no one wrote anything except JPX and Stuntman Mike from the Post Rhetoric Podcast, which you should be listening to, by the way, which is this show's after show, basically. But they're the only two that wrote anything in 2 weeks. So either you're all robots or you're all just as lazy as I am, and or you just don't have anything to say. I don't really fucking know. But no one wrote any questions. So I'm not going to do that segment as I had hoped to. So yeah, that's that. But the invitation's still out there anyway. Write me. Say something, you know. LostRhetoricPodcast@gmail.com. You can find it in the show notes. You can copy and paste it. You can click it, write me, all of that stuff. But also, leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts if you can. Leave a rating and a review anywhere you can. Share episodes, share links, all that stuff. Spread the word. Thank you, Keegan540, for a glowing review on Apple Podcasts this week. I really appreciate it. 5 stars. It's just that simple, folks. Just say a kind word, leave 5 stars. It really helps with the visibility of the show. It helps spread the word. More people will come across it if more people are talking about it. So yeah, feel free to spread the word in positivity. And yeah, again, thank you, Keegan. I know exactly who you are, my old friend, and I really appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time for leaving that nice review. Let's get into what I'm listening to this week. Well, man, it's a lot. So, I'm going to talk fast. I'm going to talk faster than I'm already talking. Cause there's quite a bit to go through and it's all over the map this week. I mean, I was in a folksy kind of like country-ish mood. And then all of a sudden I'm like listening to the gnarliest grind and whatever. You'll see. I'm going to go through the list here. First off, Show Me the Body has a new single called Survive out on Loma Vista Records. It's just a single, but they're one of the most exciting bands. They're a New York hardcore band. They're not like typical New York hardcore. They got a fucking electrified banjo, keyboards, bass, drums, and just great vocals. I had the privilege of playing a show with them a couple years ago when they were on tour. And their live shows are insane. It's such a bummer that they can't play live because of COVID. But when they come back, oh my God. When they tour through your town, go see Show Me the Body. And check out their new single, Survive. It is all energy and it is great. Socioclast. Been checking them out. Grind band from San Jose on Carbonized Records. I ordered my copy of this already. Should be coming in the mail, hopefully any day now. But, yeah, man, just really brutal grindcore, kind of an all-star lineup. Dudes from, In Disgust, Mortuous, and Dead Pressure, bands. I haven't seen Mortuous, but I played with In Disgust back in the day and seen them multiple times. I saw Dead Pressure at a practice space in Portland once. It was like me and like 3 other people. They were great. Mortuous, I know, is a fucking great, great band, like death metal band. But yeah, they're insanely brutal grind. So check out Socioclast on Carbonized Records. The record just came out. 16. That's the number 16. Just 1-6. They have an album out on Relapse Records. Came out last year called Dream Squasher, and I was checking it out. They've been around for almost 30 fucking years, this band. And, you know, I've been listening to him for years. I mean, I'm like the biggest fan or anything like that, but this album is actually really fucking good. They're, I guess, sludge metal. They kind of get called a lot. They're from Southern California, and they're the kind of like stoner shit where they'll like drop a harmonica lick in there and you're not mad about it. You know, like they just, I don't know. They're groovy. They're heavy. They're great songwriters. So yeah, check out 16 Dream Squash, a really good record. Now we're going to get into some of the more chill shit I was listening to. First Aid Kit, Swedish gals, they're sisters. They're folk, country, kind of pop vibes going on. Great songwriters, my God, great voices. Listen to all of their shit. They're great. Their last album was called Ruins on Columbia Records. That's the one I've been listening to the most recently, but it is, they're just great. Nathaniel Rateliff has an album out called And It's Still All Right from last year. Came out on Stax Records. He's a Denver guy by way of St. Louis. I'm stoked on this record. This is a forever record for me. I've already listened to it probably 10 fucking times this week, and I know it's going to be one of those albums that sticks with me for the rest of my life. It's that good. I'm going to always lean on it. It's always going to be, like on a road trip or just when I'm in the mood. It's just, every song is phenomenal. It sounds old. He's got this old 60s, 70s vibe, but it also sounds new. But he also kind of has this early alt years indie vibe when kind of like the singer-songwriter folksy movement was kind of coming back. He's kind of got that sound perfected, but just phenomenal songwriting. Great, great performances, great songs. Can't recommend this record anymore. And It's Still All Right by Nathaniel Rateliff from 2020. Check it out. It reminds me a little, not really, but it just, I love this record so much that it got me listening to a classic of from the past, from Bonnie Prince Billy, called Master and Everyone from 2003 on Drag City Records. That's one of my favorite records of all time. So I don't know if you don't know anything about Bonnie Prince Billy or Will Oldham. Just check it out. Master and Everyone was my first record that I ever heard of his. And, I think I saw him on that tour actually. Really just chill acoustic singer songwriter stuff. Oh man. Amazing. A new band to me, House of Harm. They have an album from last year called Vicious Pastimes on Avant Records. All I can say is, if you like Depeche Mode, you're going to like House of Harm. They're that vibe. They're 80s synth, kind of dark wave stuff. Great songwriting. Oh, my God. It's just incredible. Super incredible. House of Harm, Vicious Pastimes. Love it. And the last thing I was listening to is the new Mogwai album. I was a big Mogwai fan about 20-some-odd years ago. Still am, I guess. But they've been going strong for a long time, from Scotland. They have a new album out called As the Love Continues on Rock Action Records. It just came out, I think this week or last week. It's been a while, like I said, and the album didn't, knock my fucking socks off or anything. I was really hoping it would be like one of those, oh man, I haven't listened to their last three records. I've been blowing them off. Maybe they're just gonna, fucking kill me this time. And, they didn't, but the record's really great. I'm not going to say it wasn't disappointing. That's for sure. It's actually really good. And if you listen to Mogwai, it's kind of still, they're still doing what they do. That's it. That's what I've been listening to. That's a lot, man. That's a lot. I've been listening to quite a lot this week. And you can find all of this stuff on Spotify by searching LR037. It'll be on a playlist. It is collaborative. Please add to it if you feel so inclined. Let's get into the exhumed excerpts from the Tomb of the Promulgated. That's where I dig up an old story, an old sighting from the past, from some old underground source, and I give it some fresh air. These things were barely reported in the first place. And it, you know, sightings and abductions and all these things happen all the time. They've been happening for decades, centuries, and they still happen. And they get swept under the rug constantly. And I just want to remind folks that, you know, this is an ongoing thing. These things have happened, and these stories did happen to people, and no one knows about them. But they're real people. These are real things. These are real incidences that happened. And just let's not forget, you know, let's not forget their story is basically the whole point of the Exhumed excerpts. So let's get into it, man. This one is from a little magazine called Frontiers of Science. It's the July-August 1980 issue. The headline is Possible Abduction in Iowa. And it's pretty cool. They give like these little stats before you start the article. It says type CE2, Close Encounters of the Second Kind. Date, January 21st, 1980. Time, about 11:40 p.m. Duration, about 30 minutes. Witnesses, one with six secondary witnesses. Place, Council Bluffs, Iowa. So this is what the article says. The primary experience in this case, a woman in her 50s never wanted publicity, so her story did not come to light right away. A friend coaxed her to talk to a reporter from the Omaha World Herald, but she refused to let her name be known. She also withheld her name from an Omaha-based UFO researcher when she spoke with him. To this day, she won't communicate with anyone else. Her friends say she tries to dismiss the experience as something mundane. The anonymous woman was playing bridge with seven other women just as they do every 2 weeks. When the game broke up at 11:30 p.m., five of the women, including a nun, drove off with Marilyn Anderson, 37. The main witness drove alone a distance behind them. As the Anderson car proceeded north on County Road G66, the women could see a cluster of lights to their left in the western sky. No one could see a shape, Anderson told Alan Hendry. Five flashing lights could be seen, but driving the car occupied her attention. Passenger Rita Sobetsky said she saw three or four square white lights and a flashing red light. The angular size of the light cluster was huge, much larger than a full moon. Anderson estimated that the cluster was hovering 200 to 300 feet above a bluff, less than a city block away. When she stopped the car to get out and see it, it sped away to the southwest. This preliminary sighting lasted about 10 seconds. There was some discussion that this might have been simply aircraft. They were close to a landing pattern for Epley Airfield, but no one actually called at the time to find out. Ironically, the main experient never laid eyes on this formation. She was told about it by Mrs. Anderson, who ran back toward her car. Parting company with the other women, she continued toward her home near the Iowa School for the Deaf. She had not far to go when she reached Longview Drive at 11:40 p.m. Then, as she pulled up to a stop sign, her car stalled out. Her current attempt to dismiss this as a gas problem seems unlikely. Her lights and radio also conked out, yet she could restart the car. As she drove another quarter mile, the sky became a, quote, sort of pinkish orange. The car stalled again, and she stepped outside. A bright orange light appeared in a cornfield about 300 yards to her left with an intensity that hurt her eyes. Petrified, she jumped back into the car and locked the door. Then, a period of time elapsed, which she cannot remember. Her car was now turned sideways, across the road as though she had skidded on the ice, but when? The vehicle behaved properly as she drove home. From her kitchen window, she could still see the glow of the orange light. Her sister's advice was obvious. Go see a doctor. She put the decision off until the morning, however. She did not waken her husband. Instead, she remained awake all night, noticing that her blotches and redness were fading at 4 in the morning and were completely gone by 4:20 a.m. Parallels can be drawn between this case and other recent events, such as the Deputy Johnson police car collision with a blinding light source in Minnesota and the burns suffered by Officer Amparano in Kerman, California in 1978. In this case, of course, no doctor or additional witness was able to confirm the physical symptoms reported by our anonymous witness. Checks with the county sheriff's office revealed no additional UFO reports that night. Well, there you have it, folks. Another possible abduction, some missing time, a stalled car. Who knows? The lady won't talk. She's never talked. But it sounds, I don't want to say typical, but yeah, man, that mechanical failure seems to happen quite a bit. And the car ending up in a position that she doesn't know how it got there, how it skidded across the road like that. And yeah, man, it's all weird. And the injuries that she sustained, the blotches and the redness, all, I hate to say it, she was abducted. That's it. And I don't mean to laugh, but that's probably what happened. And yeah, that incident that they compared this to, Deputy Johnson, the policeman who had a collision with the blinding light in Minnesota, that is Val Johnson, Deputy Val Johnson. And I did a whole episode about him. The second episode ever of this show was about the Val Johnson incident. It was a super awesome episode that I did with the old man. Go back, check it out if you're curious about that case, because that's a fucking weird one too, man. And it's just super believable. Everything that guy says, I believe it. And same thing could have happened to this poor lady in Iowa. But yeah, that's it. That's it for the Exhumed excerpts this week. If you have any stories from this region, the Council Bluffs area in Iowa, or Iowa in general, I would love to hear from you. I want to create a web of familiarity with people who can relate to these stories because they've experienced something similar in the same region. So if you got any Iowa stories, write me, let me know. I would love to hear from you. I mean, this happened all the way back in 1980. It was 40 years ago, but that doesn't really matter. Let's just see who has experienced something in the same area and put it all together, man. Let's do it. Write me. LostRhetoricPodcast@gmail.com. All right. Tonight, as I have mentioned before, we are getting into Jack Parsons. Grace Bigler is with me. And that's all I can say. We're going to have this discussion. And here it is.
Grace.
Hello.
Hey, you can hear me.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can. And I hope everyone else can too. Oof.
How good evening to you.
Good evening. Yeah, sorry. I'm kind of recording from the jump here. No pressure.
It's all good.
I know you just got off work and all that.
Yeah.
That good stuff. So thank you.
I did.
Thank you for taking your time.
Of course. I'm excited to delve into this wacky topic.
It is pretty wacky, man. I mean, I've been digging kind of deep, not as deep as I should have, because well, first off, tonight I've already talked about it in the intro, but we're going to be talking about Jack Parsons. What a fucking wild man, to say the least. But yeah, I should have dug a little deeper because I just got the book Strange Angel by George Pendle in the mail today. And I haven't even I haven't even looked at it really. There were a couple cool little quotes because he has a quote at the beginning of every chapter.
Mm-hmm.
That I feel there's a couple of them that seem to set the mood, I think. Do you mind if I read them?
Yeah, go for it.
There's a couple. First, there's just the initial quote to kind of open the book before it even starts. A quote by Robert Lowell that goes, "No rocket goes as far astray as man." I mean, we'll see if that's true. And then in the prologue, he has a quote from Ellen Glasgow from her book, The Woman Within. And the quote is, "Moderation has never yet engineered an explosion." Pretty good.
Okay. Yeah, those are good. And, those are really good.
Well, moderation is not Jack Parsons' strong suit.
No.
Or it wasn't.
No, it wasn't.
And he caused a lot of explosions. And he was a fucking wild man. He was a rock star, man. I'm telling you, everything that I read about this guy, he just seemed like your kind of stereotypical wild man in any scenario. Like whatever profession you got, it doesn't matter. Like sports or music, or like this guy is just the fucking wild card and shit's just crazy.
He walks in the door and is like, "Let's do it."
Yeah, exactly.
No credentials or anything. Just like
zero.
He's got a plan and he's got the joie de vivre, I guess.
He's got
He sweeps people up. Yeah.
He's got the it factor. Well, I mean, I guess that might answer my first question, but you know, we're obviously going to get into his whole life story, but a good jumping off point, I guess, would be what led you, like, what's your interest in Jack Parsons and like, how did you come to learn about him? And what's so intriguing about him that we're doing this tonight?
Well, he's a famous Thelemite or practitioner of Thelema, which is a spiritual practice that I used to be involved in back in my college days.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that I was part of that community, but never attended a class or a talk or anything. I've never really directly learned about Jack Parsons. So, this topic felt like a good excuse to learn about him and, just his crazy life.
Yeah. Is he in Thelema? Is he not a celebrated individual in any way, or is he kind of?
I think he's a little bit of a controversial figure. He's probably more celebrated and talked about in the LA Thelemic community because he that was where he was, and that's where there'd be a little bit more legacy connected rather than the East Bay, which is where I was part of a community in Oakland, California. So he never really came up, but I did read a little bit about how some Thelemites consider him kind of like a heretic because he wrote an additional chapter to the central holy book that it's pretty widely accepted that anybody who writes another chapter is pretty much generally considered a kook. So
the word is set in stone, no amendments.
Yeah. Okay. Except he did a little he did a magical working where he wrote a fourth chapter. So I think some Thelemites probably don't enjoy that or don't appreciate that very much.
It's interesting because He seems to be slightly ostracized from the two passions in his life, which were rocketry and rocket science and the practice of Thelema.
Yeah.
And he's a black sheep in both. And it seems like his legacy is a little wiped out on both on both fronts.
It's like a rocket in the sky when it smokes out and starts to fade.
Oh man. Yeah. I don't know. Well, I guess we can, well, I guess just a general, definition of Thelema before we continue, because it's going to come up a lot. I mean, what is it real quick?
Okay, it's I have to preface here a little bit. I am not in any way, shape, or form an authority.
Oh
on
yeah,
on this topic.
Yeah, that's the whole premise of this show.
It's informative,
not definitive. You know.
Yeah, when I was a part of the OTO and practicing Thelema.
What does OTO stand for?
OTO is Ordo Templi Orientis. It's like the body. It's kind of like an initiatic structure. There's some, I don't know. I can't even fully describe it. It's easy to look up.
Okay.
Look it up and read it?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Well, if anyone needs to know, they can look it up. But this is what Jack Parsons, he was a part of this as well.
Yeah, he was part of, so the OTO and Thelema, the religion or spirituality that kind of underpins the order, was started by Aleister Crowley in the 20s or 30s. And, so Jack Parsons was, he joined the OTO later after it had been developed and took root in the US and whatnot. And Crowley identified Parsons as a possible like head honcho kind of guy in OTO. But like you said, he fell out of favor towards the end of his short life. Mm-hmm. So he never rose to that echelon of leadership, but he was a favorite of Crowley for a time.
Yeah, and they never even actually met, I've read. They just corresponded.
Yeah.
So he kind of got higher up there, possibly in the ranks, by reputation alone.
Just reputation, yeah.
See, and that's what he did in his life. That's what he's everything he did, he just walked into the room, was like, we're fucking partying, you know, like I'm in charge. We're doing it. I don't know what it is, but we're fucking doing it. And everyone's going to listen to me.
Yeah, totally.
Just that guy.
Well, there's a part of that too, that says something about how Aleister Crowley interacted with people in his life as well. He, are you familiar with the Thoth Tarot? It's like a tarot deck.
No.
That he helped kind of design, really interesting, crazy artwork. And the way that deck was developed was through written correspondence between him and the artist, Lady Frieda Harris. I'm sure they must have met in person, not like Parsons, not ever meeting, but it just took years of writing back and forth and kind of coaching her around what he wanted in the images. And he was a prolific writer, you know, correspondence and other types of writing.
Yeah, man. Well, he was prolific on many counts. Thelema, yeah, we'll get it.
Yeah,
we'll get
it. Definition of Thelema, I kind of trailed away from that. So the central tenet of Thelema is this phrase, "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law,"
mm-hmm.
which is supposed to be explored and interpreted by the individual in the study and practice of the literature, blah, blah, blah. But my understanding of it at the time when I practiced it, I don't know what it's looking like nowadays, is to fit, like, each individual has the right to self-fulfillment and actualization. And yeah, it's very individual focused and wants to develop from the inside out, like full spiritual potential, I guess. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But but there's also Gnostic mass kind of ceremonies, and then a lot of people think it's like a fucking like sex cult. Mm-hmm. Like sex is a big part of it, and it's really hedonistic, and it can allow people with certain excesses to go a little overboard, maybe, and maybe a little power hungry or something. And a lot of people think maybe Jack Parsons was just a little too wrapped up into certain aspects of it.
Sure, yeah.
That were more indulgent. I don't really know.
If Crowley wrote a lot of essays in a more cogent state of mind, where he kind of tries to clarify what he means by a true will and what he means by spiritual fulfillment, all that stuff, he basically was kind of like a syncretist. I don't know if that's the right word. He he took different concepts and practices and ideas from philosophical and spiritual approaches all around the world and tried to put them together in this mishmash of a space of becoming your full self. And if that involves hedonistic sex orgies 48 hours at a time, if it's consensual and it adds to the benefit of your life and it allows you to be a part of a community that includes other people whose right to fulfill their true will, accomplish their true will, is also supported, then go for it. But he also, he gives some pretty clear, I guess it's clear if you can get through a sentence that's a half a page long. He does try to rein it in too. Like, he talks a lot about discipline, and yeah, not doing anything else that wastes your time and energy because it's finite.
Right. So focus. Move with purpose and intention.
Exactly. If you're having 48 hour long orgies for, weeks on end and taking little breaks in between, you have to be really clear about why you're doing that.
Right.
Because it's easy to lose track of why in that kind of environment.
What's the end goal there?
Yeah.
Well, let's start getting into how Jack Parsons got there and got into this shit and got into everything, because it seems like at a very, very early age he was into the occult and he was into rocketry and he was into all sorts of things that were considered taboo or just insane. Because you got to keep in mind, when he was a kid in the 20s and 30s, like, rocketry and rocket science was bonkers. That was cuckoo. That was for crazy people.
It was science fiction.
Yeah, it was like, you don't, no one's taking you seriously.
Yeah.
But that's the shit he was into at a very, very young age. And the occult as well at a very young age. So his whole short life was fucking rocket science and the occult, like married.
Together. I'm not sure what about his childhood, like, exposed him to summoning demons and shit. Like, what weird magazine did he pick up on, like, the train?
Because all the, I haven't read the book yet, but everything that I read was just that he was into science fiction, and he was into Jules Verne, and he was into like pulp magazines, and he was into just weird fiction.
Yeah.
That must have gotten his imagination just going at a very, I don't know, young age. But I mean, he also kind of had an interesting, I'd say, somewhat lonely upbringing. Like, he's a product of divorce. His real name is Marvel, which is crazy. That's like, he should, I mean, his whole life, if he just went by Marvel Parsons, holy shit.
Well, he was named after his dad, who
who
dipped on the family.
His dad's total cheating piece of shit that left his wife and had another kid. So he's got a half brother out there that he met once, maybe. You know, but yeah, deadbeat dad, mom, fucking raised him, but she comes from money. So he actually grew up in Pasadena in a very rich neighborhood.
And Millionaire Mile or something like that.
Millionaire's Mile, the I guess road or neighborhood was called. So, you know, he seemed pretty comfortable in that regard, but on a personal level, not so hot here. And his mom renamed him, right? Like John, like a familial name, and everyone calls him Jack. John Whiteside Parsons is his name. His middle name's Whiteside. I think that's her maiden name. I don't really fucking
that's
know.
Pretty that I don't think I've ever heard of that in like a modern context of like being called so-and-so junior and the dad fucks off, so you just straight up rename your kid.
Right.
I've never heard of that. That's kind of intense.
Yeah. I mean, that's your life story, man. I mean, that's like, when did he stop telling that whole story to people? You know?
Yeah.
he just became Jack, and that's it. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you know, there's this broken home, but super rich neighborhood, weird kid running around. They said he started building simple gunpowder rockets in his backyard, and he would make them with burned out cardboard tubes and flaming paper, and he would just fuck shit up. And he just always, I mean, no, I never heard that he was a quote pyromaniac or anything. Like, he didn't just like light shit on fire. He was actually trying to launch things and explode things. Like, he was building not bombs, but, you know, devices.
Yeah.
he was curious how these things worked, you know. And I guess he was also like a pretty bad student, and he was dyslexic as well, and he got bullied quite a bit. And you know, everything he was into was just, like I said, batshit crazy. So he just must have been very eccentric.
He was a young dude. Yeah, he was a young man with some resources.
Yeah,
but but a pretty shitty situation, I think, psychologically. And so I think a kid in that time being really interested in science fiction and blowing shit up in your backyard of your mansion is like, it's very, there's some escapism happening. Mm-hmm. Like he's wanting to escape, and that's really kind of sad and cute at the same time. Like mm-hmm. the earliest rocket scientist, you know, really wants to get the fuck off Earth.
Yeah. No, that's that could be it, man. Just born of that pain. Like, I want the fuck out of here by any means. Like, even if I got to create the means, I'm going
to,
I'm leaving this place.
It's got to be possible to get off this miserable rock.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, we're speculating, of course, but could be.
Mm-hmm.
Could be. I mean, but he had such a drive to figure these things out. We joked about it earlier, but it's true. He had no like formal education in this stuff at all. He was a fucking dropout.
Yeah. Which is really interesting to think about, like one of the earliest scientists of rocket propulsion, like that whole concept. It's like, it's not rocket science is a phrase that mm-hmm. we use. It's like, you don't need a fancy degree to figure this out. It's like,
right.
The original guy was a total maverick, you know, mm-hmm.
absolutely
not part of the, not industry, but what's the word I'm looking for? The fold.
I'm not sure, Grace.
Yeah. I don't know. You get what I'm saying.
Yeah man. Now I'm lost. I was looking at something and I got confused. But yeah, you were talking about it's not rocket science. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about this quote that I had found and lost about how that was born. It's basically what you were saying. It's a saying to say, you don't have to be smart to understand this. It's not rocket science, because rocket science is the hardest thing in the world to understand.
Yes.
But it was created by an uneducated person in a time where rocket science was so looked down upon
that it was just like, so far-fetched.
It was a fool's fucking errand. Like, only idiots would even conceive of the endeavor in general. Like, no one's even going to approach it. It's so dumb. But now it's like the smartest thing you could possibly do. To the point where it's a saying, it's not rocket science, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway,
exactly.
I got a bit jumbled there, Grace. I was zoning out.
It's okay.
But yeah, this guy seriously dropped out. I mean, his education's weird. I mean, he spent time at a few different colleges, and the Depression hit, and his family actually took their fortune kind of dwindled.
So
there was like financial troubles there when he was a young, teenager, young man,
like a young adult. Yeah.
Yeah. But at this time he's already established, the Suicide Squad, which is what they were known as, which is like his childhood buddy, Ed Foreman, and a few other dudes where they would get together and,
try to shit up.
Yeah, exactly. Like they had a penchant for blowing things up, and they were associated with or I don't know if anyone was actually going to the Caltech. Like, I really don't
I think
know.
Some of the guys were students of Caltech, and he just kind of walked in the door and was like, I'm working on this stuff. I'm curious if anyone else is interested. He needed resources and like a little bit of theoretical backup to his experiments.
Yeah.
Found some folks who wanted to do it with him that were students.
Yeah, they were a team that had strengths, and I guess Parsons, he was like the chemist of the group.
Mm-hmm.
There was like, and Foreman was the machinist, and this guy Molina was, they said, the technical theoretician.
Mm-hmm.
So they, I don't know, they all brought their strengths to the table to push the envelope. But it's funny, they were called the Suicide Squad because everyone kind of expected them to blow themselves up. That was the whole that was the joke, is these guys are fucking crazy, shit keeps exploding, they're all gonna die from their own hands. They're gonna all eventually die, which well, spoiler, it happened to eventually.
Yeah, you play with matches, you're gonna get on caught on fire.
Yeah,
that's what happened here.
So while Parsons and Foreman and Frank Molina, they're tinkering around with all this stuff, these are the guys that through, they create a couple companies. There's the Gausset Rocket Research Group,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, they were, it says that they formed a Caltech affiliated group that was supported by the Guggenheim Aeronautical Laboratory, which is super legit. Like, they get all this backing and funding eventually.
Yeah.
Where they basically convince folks to give them money to blow shit, to keep blowing shit up, basically.
Well, to refine the
yeah, there's experiment. There's only one way to do it. You gotta blow shit up, you know? And it's just like Ellen Glasgow said, moderation has never yet engineered an explosion.
That's true.
Like, but these guys, I mean, they were they convinced the National Academy of Sciences to give them money, and they did this genius thing eventually where they kind of changed the wording from rocket science or something to a jet propulsion.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of like gained legitimacy because propulsion was something that they could get behind, like the military could get behind.
The military specifically.
Yeah. So
the military can't do much with rocket science, but you can definitely strap a bomb on some jet propulsion
right
situation.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to me, like what year did all that happen? Like, were we actively at war, World War II? Is that why the military like signed on to these crazy kids experiments? Or
yeah,
like, was there an urgent need, basically, is what I'm asking.
I think it sounds like there could have been, I don't know if it was a need or at least just not desperation, but the need to explore all avenues to see mm-hmm. if anything could come of it, because this was the late 30s and early 40s. All of this was happening. Mm-hmm. Like the Gausset group was, I think 1939. And then, so then we go to war. And then after World War II started, they founded Aerojet, mm-hmm. company Aerojet, in 1942 to develop and sell their, jet assisted takeoff technology. And then, mm-hmm. The Gausset group that they created became JPL in 1943. So it was during the war, and JPL is still Jet Propulsion Laboratories. That is still around. And,
mm-hmm.
Very actually important historically, And Aerojet is still around as well, but it's known as Aerojet Rocketdyne. And they manufacture rocket and missile propulsion systems. So two of the companies that he started in the early 40s are still fucking around doing the same work. And they innovated a lot of stuff. And JPL, of course, is pretty well known, but there's the joke that JPL stands for Jack Parsons Laboratory or Jack Parsons Lives.
Oh, God.
But I digress. But yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
So they're shaking shit
up, man. I have a quick recommendation for you and for anyone who is interested in World War II era military, like US military and its involvement in like LA. There's this really great series documentary on Netflix called Five Came Back. Have you seen that?
Oh no, I haven't. No, but explain what it is.
It's it talks about these five like kind of successful directors that were around LA at the same time as Jack Parsons was doing his Suicide Squad shit. And the military basically commissioned these five guys to make films about the war and to try to educate the US, try to get people on board with getting involved in the war. So it's kind of interesting to think of. I thought of it because of this idea of these weird like military guys just walking around LA like trying to figure out how to get talented men to sign on their skills, whatever it is, whether it's jet propulsion technology or like directing a movie, trying to commission them. It's just like a weird like relationship between US military superpower shit and then Los Angeles and Hollywood. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it seems like it. And Parsons was tied into Hollywood as well. Like, I mean, the movie picture business.
Yeah.
I mean, not as much as whatever these fellas that you're talking about, but yeah, it is an interesting dynamic, huh?
Yeah, just like military contractors trying to get people to commit their services to the betterment of the military somehow. It's interesting.
That is interesting. Well, I don't know exactly what, if anything, these groups, the like Aerojet or JPL specifically did, if anything, for the war effort, other than, I mean, they just, I mean, it was also new, you know, like they were just getting the fund. They were just getting the funding. They were getting they were getting quite a big chunk of change, man. I think they eventually started getting like $100,000. You know, they started out getting they requested $100,000, but they received 22,000 eventually. But yeah, that's still so much money.
Yeah.
In the early 40s, $22,000. That is pretty insane. But around this time, you know, when they do the genius, you know, from rocketry to jet propulsion move and start their companies and they start making good money and the government is all behind them. They're the first US government sanctioned rocket research group, you know, like they're making moves. They're doing stuff. Parsons is kind of personally getting real into the occult.
Yeah, on the side or whatever. It's interesting how so much of the writing about Parsons, like, even at the time, especially at the time of his death, the way people viewed him was very like scientist by day and wizard man by night, like right. Kind of separating the two. But I think the extent, I mean, he wasn't like doing anything half-assed. Like he was 100%, like both feet in the water in both of these things. I don't think you could really separate. I don't think he really separated.
No, I don't think so. They were the one and the same, man.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's part of his whole thing is science and magic are essentially the same, you know? Like I read this Vice article and this guy kind of explained it, I think, pretty well about rocketry and magic and Parsons trying to excel at both and bring the two together because they were so similar. Mm-hmm. This is what he says. I'm going to read it real quick. He says, rocketry postulated that we should no longer see ourselves as creatures chained to the earth, but as beings capable of exploring the universe. Similarly, magic suggested there were unseen metaphysical worlds that existed and could be explored with the right knowledge. Both were rebellions against the very limits of human existence and striving for one, he could not help but strive for the other. Like, mm-hmm. I think that's a really good way to think about his approach to rocketry and magic and how they weren't like mutually exclusive.
Right. Yeah.
Like they actually work together.
Yeah, they do. And there's a way that Crowley encouraged his Thelemites to practice spirituality in a way that was not like through blind faith, like not to like it's not important whether or not the goddess of Babylon exists as an entity. It what's important is if you do certain things, then certain results will follow, and it's your job as a magician and practitioner to try certain things and then pay attention to what happens and record it. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what a scientist does as well, is who isn't looking for a specific result of something. They want to know. There's a curiosity kind of that underpins, you know, if I put these chemicals together, what kind of explosion will occur as a result, and then recording, you know, what happens. And it's the same. It's kind of a similar. I don't know if Jack Parsons was a like tooth and nail, he believed in the reality and existence of demons and angels and blah blah blah, all that shit. But most my experience with Thelema and ceremonial ritual is just kind of like looking at it from a perspective of usefulness and suspension of disbelief, so that you can see what happens as a result of allowing yourself to believe in a thing that you're saying. Does that mm-hmm. make sense?
Yeah, it kind of does. And as an example of how he kind of tied the two together, And I guess kind of what you're talking about is he would recite the hymn to Pan. Is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm.
Before launches, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And to, God, I'm not going to explain it very well, but to, I mean, just to fucking do it and see what the result of it is. Like,
yeah,
just, I'm going to launch this rocket. I'm going to say this hymn and see what happens. And why the fuck not? Like, like, no, you know, people thought he was obviously crazy because he would say it out loud. And I think loudly, at least in the depictions I've seen of it. But yeah, yeah, but it's just, if you got that intention and you're
focusing it,
he's experimenting. He's like, you don't know what the result's going to be unless you fucking try it and keep doing it and change it if you got to or whatever the fuck, but man, just go for it. And he was just, do what thou wilt. Right. I mean, that's what he was doing. he's the only person in the history reciting, hymns, like occult hymns while blowing shit up, trying to take man to space. I don't know. It's pretty wild stuff to think about.
Yeah, it is. It kind of reminds me a little bit of, like, have you ever read about or learned about, like, magical thinking in sports?
Mm-mm.
Like how people will have their little, like, thing that they do. It's like a little tradition. Like, I wear the same pair of underwear every time.
Oh, they're superstitions.
Yeah. The superstitious, it's magical thinking essentially. Of,
yeah. Cause like in basketball, when players shoot free throws, mm-hmm. almost every player has some ritual.
Little ritual, yeah,
that they do, and if they don't do it, you know, they're gonna miss. But when they do miss, I mean, you know, what's the point? I don't know.
It's yeah, it's but accounted, yeah, to something. But I remember when I first learned about that, and probably in a psychology class and in college, something that I remembered that stood out to me was that sports that have more to do with luck have, rather than skill, have higher like rates of reported superstitious behavior or like good luck,
mm-hmm.
Rituals and behavior. So I think the example was baseball.
It's like the most superstitious sport in the history of the world,
I think. Yeah, totally. And there, I'm not saying that it doesn't take skill to be good at baseball, but there are so many variables that are out of the player's control that whatever they can do, rubbing their nose 7 times and spitting sideways and adjusting their balls is like,
it's all like OCD in a way.
Yeah. It's built in and it gives a little sense of some control.
Yeah.
And it's something that you can attribute success to, and it's something that you can blame failure on. And in either case, it works.
Right. It's so interesting. Well, speaking of failures, though, at this point in the timeline in Parsons' life, when we talked about the success and the creation of his companies and JPL and Aerojet, mm-hmm. and all that stuff, and he's really starting to blossom in his thelemic endeavors, it seems like all around the same time, like he's peaking, he's jumping, mm-hmm. he's jumping the fucking shark right now, because he essentially got bought out, kind of fired from his own fucking companies for just being, he was just too excessive, man. He was just partying. He was like treating JPL as his own playground. And he was like trying to get women to come to his house, which he called the Parsonage, which he bought, I think, at the same neighborhood that he grew up in, Millionaire's Mile or whatever. Mm-hmm. He bought a big house in Pasadena that was just, there were no rules in terms of who could be there. He let anyone come and stay there. It didn't matter. Mm. It was just a constant activity in his house. But then he would go to work the next day late or drunk or still
high
or just doing whatever. I mean, like, he was blending both worlds.
And a little too much for his scientist counterpart's comfort, I'm sure.
Yeah, the serious science people handling all the explosives were like, Jack, you're drunk again. you're not wearing pants again.
He rolled up in his tow robe.
Yeah, you drove in reverse 6 miles to get here, and you're speaking gibberish again. So we're gonna have to let you go. And that's what they did. He basically like burned himself out professionally. He burned all of his bridges. He blew him up. He did exactly what he's good at. He blew all of his professional relationships to shit. And that's when he started getting even weirder into the occult and the Lemmick.
Well, he had all this extra free time now.
Yeah, he had nothing but time at this point. you know, and we're kind of glossing over his, there's things that he's done. There's like achievements that he's got professionally, but and there's certain like fun things that he's done in his life professionally. But what it all boils down to is he created a bunch of shit or was part of it, and then he just kind of ruined it. It's just the typical story of a guy who he burned out, man.
No scientist has real ownership over a technology that they, you know. I think if it hadn't been him, you know, someone else would have figured it out. You know what I mean? It's not like he left it in good hands, especially if those companies still exist.
And
working on shit. Like he just couldn't be a part of it anymore.
He's just too, he was no longer
productive.
He's just too fucking wild, you know.
Well, I wonder how much of that was not just like the excess of crazy sex parties all the time, but also I'm curious about what you found about his drug use during this time.
Well,
I saw a poem. I found a poem that he published about doing peyote and cocaine and stuff like that.
It's so funny that you mentioned that, Grace, because you don't know this, but everyone that's listening to the show has already heard me recite that at the top of the show.
Oh, okay.
but yeah, he talks about doing cocaine and peyote and marijuana. But I didn't really find too much. I assume he was on drugs and drinking and definitely, you know, smoking weed and all that stuff. But at the time of his death, which we will get into, they found some morphine. So he may have been into some shit like that as well.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And that could have been a later life thing for him. I don't know if he was doing that.
He was like 37.
Yeah. Well, you know. When you die at 37, that's your later life.
Yeah, I guess so.
not to laugh, but yeah. But he started getting into, or he started hanging around L. Ron Hubbard.
Yeah.
let's just jump to that, because there's things that he did personally. Like, he's got a wife at this point, an artist wife who is a part of his life and religion, but I think it got a little too much for her even.
Mm-hmm.
And she left, from what I understand. So his personal life is like up and down. And, you know, he's also, like we've said, he's just a wild man, right? So his whole life, he's just been on the fringe of society. And that makes him, he's like an actual person of interest for the FBI. Because of his political ties, he's always dabbled like Marxism, socialism, communism. He's got beef with the government, and he's got beef with cops and like the moral police. There's rumors that he was possibly bisexual, you know? So he was just,
God forbid.
I know. He was just a fucking nuisance, Grace.
Yeah.
You know, so, and he is obviously well aware of this.
For 1940s. America, California.
Yeah.
What a nuisance. What a ne'er-do-well.
What a nuisance. Robert Anton Wilson described, I guess he was more talking about his Parsons' political writings, but he said that they exemplified an ultra-individualist who exhibited a genuine sympathy for working people. And he strongly empathized with feminism, you know, and the only reason I say that is because at the heart of this man, he seemed to have some pretty good ideals about living life and doing, I guess, the right thing, or just being like a moral and just society.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, he was like way into, you know, the freedom of the individual, obviously, but you know, he was progressive, like too progressive for the time, it seemed.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like the man was coming down on him, you know, every once in a while.
Yeah, well, I think philosophically he was kind of like a proto libertarian almost. Mm-hmm. Like, In terms of the, I don't know, the true sense of the word liberty, like individual freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Not in like the creepy kind of crawly association that I have with libertarianism.
Creepy crawly.
It gives me the heebie-jeebies a little bit, but
mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's kind of what I understood about his ideals. Was he was a Thelemite, definitely to the core.
To the core. And yeah, like we mentioned, Crowley took notice of that and kind of gave him I guess it's kind of a leadership role on the West Coast of America, in a sense. Like he had some kind of like authority in LA, I guess.
Yeah.
He definitely had a reputation within the group, within the religion. But he started going off the deep end. like I said.
And here comes little Hubbard man here.
Yeah, little fucking Elrond, man.
Elrond is such a nightmare. You know, my first real introduction to Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard is a spoken word performance by one of his kids, like his son. Mm-hmm. Who's a poet. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't.
It's a really crazy way to learn about Scientology, to see a video of a performance of the son of this guy, like totally denouncing him.
Wow.
It's really interesting. I should look up the name. I think it's Jamie DeWolf.
No, that's definitely worth looking into. That'd be pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah. If you started with a poem, you should find another one.
And I'll end with one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the power this guy has, Elrond, I mean, he was pretty young when he met Jack Parsons, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But he shows up with his refulgent eyes. And he's just undeniable. He's got a charisma. There's something about this guy. And he kind of sweeps Parsons up. And they do some weird shit. some shit that Crowley caught wind of and wasn't very happy about. And what is it? Because you have a better handle on this ritual that they attempted than I do, I think.
The Babylon working.
Babylon working. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the one where a result of that working. I can't think of another word for it. Basically over several days he performed a bunch of rituals kind of in succession and did some invocations and stuff, and a result of it was the writing of the fourth chapter, which I talked about earlier, is like kind of a shitty thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean it happened. It you can't really undo it, or I don't know, but yeah, they did some shit in the desert and wrote it all down, which I think is kind of a cool or important part of that practice. Is like, it's very important that you not just fuck around and say shit and see shit in your room, but to actually like be disciplined enough to write it down and keep an accurate record.
Right.
So the Babylon working, the text of what they produced, you can read it online. It's pretty cool.
It sounds intense. It seems like Parsons did a lot of the actual ritual activity and Hubbard kind of did the documentation. Am I wrong about that? Like, he kind of observed and helped or assisted or something?
Yeah, that sounds accurate.
Maybe facilitated, mm-hmm. pulled the strings as he does. I don't really know. But yeah. What I've read is the whole point of this Babylon working is to incarnate an actual goddess on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've read is for weeks that they engaged in ritual chanting, drawing occult symbols in the air with swords, dripping animal blood on runes, and masturbating in order to impregnate magical tablets.
That all checks out.
It sounds like some like Immaculate Conception kind of ritual, like they're trying to create a person.
Yeah, the idea that there's a really clear like an attempt to incarnate, like to for there to be such a specific end goal is kind of where the two roads kind of diverge. It's like when Crowley heard about this, you know, I'm sure he had some feelings about L. Ron Hubbard at that point anyway, but the idea that you're trying to achieve a certain specific result is kind of where you kind of lose track of following your true will, kind of. So, like I was saying earlier, this idea of like scientific spirituality being, I'm going to try this thing and then I'm going to pay attention to what happens afterwards. Mm-hmm. There's a line in the Book of the Law that says, true will delivered from the lust of result is every way perfect. So if you're doing a ritual in order to get a really rad job that will make you $100,000 a year, the idea that you're trying to make something really specific happen, mm-hmm. is not what I think thelemic intentional magic is supposed to be.
So it's supposed to go into it with no expectations, no results, desired results, and whatever happens it obviously changes you in some way, and you decide how to react to it and what it is, and you gotta just ride that wave of the effect of what you created.
I mean, it's the idea of having a lust for a certain result. So I was thinking about this today about like, obviously right now there's COVID vaccines that are being approved, and there's going to be some kind of general mistrust around them, because it's hard for us to imagine a scientist or a scientific community pumping out a vaccine as fast as they did. You know, their goal, right, going to work every day is obviously to get a vaccine that will create immunity for this specific, you know, viral infection. And so we've all seen what happens to a scientist in like evil superhero movies and stuff like that. Like, when a scientist is so focused on getting a desired result that they ignore the actual result of the mm-hmm. experiment in front of them. They try to shove a round peg in a square hole and then call it good.
Right.
And that kind of, we can see that, how that works and how that doesn't work in a scientific context. And it's the same, I think, in a spiritual one, where if what you're going for is a sense of inner peace, you can try to do a meditation for 15 minutes every morning before you have your coffee, and then kind of be open to the idea that, you know, I still don't feel that peaceful. So maybe I need to adjust like the time of day that I do this practice, or maybe I need to, you know, it's not about the achievement of the inner peace. It's about the honest observation of the process, mm-hmm. and the participation in the process.
Yeah.
So bringing it back to the Babylon working, the idea that it was an attempt to incarnate an actual goddess on earth is kind of, you're getting into the mad, evil, bought out scientist,
right,
you know, realm of practicing well, magic.
We can all see what not accepting the results does to a person, especially in this country. this past few months, it'll drive you crazy if you just don't accept the results and figure out how to just make some adjustments instead of getting mad about that it didn't work.
I hope my mention of the of vaccines and like general mistrust around them, I'm not endorsing like, yeah, you should definitely not trust it. I don't want that to come off as in that way. But yeah, I just wanted to bring it up as a context of what we expect a scientist to do, which is to approach an experiment with a curiosity and a discipline that, you know, as much as you might want this specific result, you have to follow each step to get there.
Right. And
you can't cut corners as much as you might want to.
Yeah. And you can't deny a result that wasn't favorable.
Right.
To whatever.
You can't judge what happens. You have to observe it and build from that point forward.
Right. Well, that being said, this Babylon working ritual that they performed here was a success, according to Parsons.
Mm-hmm.
But not so much to pretty much everyone else.
That's cool. You know, I think that
he took something positive from it. So
yeah,
it does seem like a success. In that regard, Crowley caught wind of it and was very pissed because he doesn't like Ron L. Ron Hubbard, even though he never met him. He knows the guy's a shyster. Yeah. And people were warning Crowley of L. Ron getting into Jack's head and, like, you know, manipulating him. And they were doing shit that maybe a bit suspect, but Parsons said that the ritual was successful because he met almost immediately a woman named Marjorie Cameron in his own home. She came to his house, and what it says is he regarded her as the elemental that he and Hubbard had called through the ritual. Like, he had summoned her. And she was the living proof. She was the embodiment of this, of the ritual, you know? They got married.
That's really cool.
Hey,
it's also really cool when
a
baseball player throws a no-hitter game and he scratched his balls in this very specific way right before the game. Yep. You know, I mean, it what's interesting is that the Babylon working, there's a document preserving what they did from their perspective, and I have not read it, and I don't have the time, energy, or interest to try. Maybe I will someday down the line, but it's valuable to look at the record of the working, and especially any writing that he might have done about it afterwards to get a sense of what his experience of it was and why he felt it was a success. Because that, I mean, I'm not gonna, at the end of the game, the pitcher still hits the, you know, he still pitches the no-hitter game, so
right,
and wins the sport for whatever the whatever the fuck. I don't understand sports whatsoever, but I do understand the relationship between, you do certain things and then certain things follow. Doesn't mean that there's a causal relationship between them, but there is a pattern that makes some sense in our little animal brains, and that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like with anything, it's your reaction to a certain thing. His reaction to that Babylon working ritual, or not, I mean, he thought it was successful. He felt really good about it. And then immediately this woman shows up. And how, in the way his brain works, he cannot think of it any other way than this is the result. Like, no, maybe, I mean, L. Ron Hubbard didn't think of it that way because he ran off with some woman and stole a bunch of Parsons' money.
Yeah.
Like, that was, they had two different reactions to this, this ritual. It was actually Parsons' girlfriend that he ran off with, and he ran $20,000 of his money. But Parsons still thought that this ritual was the greatest achievement of his life. And he did meet his future wife, and he believes it's because of it. And why not? If that is what he believes, and that's how the timeline played out, and everything was clicking in his brain in that way, who the fuck is anyone else to say that he didn't cause this? You know what I mean?
It's a really magnified, intentional kind of exploitation of a very normal psychological process that happens of priming, where you prime yourself. You're learning your seven times tables in school, and then you start seeing multiples of seven everywhere around you. You've been primed, and doing you're aware, doing invocations for several days with the aid of drugs and masturbation and all the other fun shit they did, like leading up to, he's primed himself to see this energy in a woman. And when someone sees an energy in you, it comes out of you more too. It's like, it makes sense. It's not, I don't subscribe to she was an incarnate version of the goddess, but if that's how a person, thinks about it or talks about it, like and it doesn't hurt anyone or themselves, that doesn't bother me.
Yeah, there's two. What's interesting is the other side of this, which is her story. What's Marjorie's story? because to him, she is the Scarlet Woman, Babylon. Like, he called her forth in a ritual, and she showed up at the right exact time. But what's her story? Why the fuck was she there? Why did she feel called there, or was it just dumb luck? But either way, she went along with it and they got married. But just imagine if that were you, where you show up to some guy's house and he just looks at you in such awe, and he's just like, tells you this crazy story about how he summoned you. Not everyone's gonna be super stoked on that.
No, definitely not.
Some people are gonna fucking run away and never talk to that person again. And you know what I mean?
Well, if she's showing up on his doorstep of the parsonage, she's probably got some, she's not just like a Latter-day Saint knocking on the door. She's probably got some connection to Thelema or OTO in some sense anyway. So yeah,
she's more open to,
she's down.
Yeah, she's down. And that just lends to the validity of his belief in the whole success of the ritual. You know, like, not only did she show up, like, she wanted to be there, you know, and the timing is impeccable. So,
That's cool.
More power to them. Like the, that's just a, in Hollywood, it's just a love story.
Yep. Yes.
but yeah, you know, Elrond ran off with his then girlfriend, Parsons' girlfriend, you know, and I assume he immediately, or around the same time, met Marjorie, and they soon were married. But this, you know, he spun out, he got depressed anyway, you know, like it's. He, this is the thing too, because he, okay, so let's get into his death, because it wasn't too long after, I guess, he's married to Marjorie. Hubbard's stolen his money. He's out of the rocketry business. He's out of the OTO. He's like, just married to the woman he summoned. What a life.
You know? I mean, that's pretty chill. You got the Scarlet Woman herself. That's,
what else do you need?
You don't need very much. You
did it.
Yeah.
Just call it good. But, you know, he was kind of piecing work together. He was still like in the explosives business. So he was just kind of messing with that. He was in Hollywood and he was, you know, doing explosions for movies and shit like that. He was just like putting together a living with his expertise, mm-hmm. you know, and they had planned a trip to Mexico. And this is in 1952, June of 1952 now. So he's 37 years old. He's gone through the ringer professionally and, you know, personally. But they're planning this trip to Mexico for a vacation. And apparently he's feeling out some job opportunity there at an explosives factory that he wants to check mm-hmm. out a job opportunity with the Mexican government. And then their ultimate goal is they wanted to move to Israel. And they wanted to start a family, and he could get his rocketry career back over there. And
because by this time he'd been basically blacklisted by mm-hmm. the U.S. government.
Yeah, and the FBI is, he's convinced the FBI is spying on him at this point, so there's some paranoia going on here. But like I said, he is a person of interest at all mm-hmm. times because of his, because of everything, everything. But the day before they're supposed to go on this trip to Mexico on June 17th, he got a rush order of explosives for a film set. And so he started to whip them up in his home lab.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened, Grace? What do you think
happened? he was thinking about that beach in Mexico. He was mm-hmm. he was not focused on what was in front of him. And he blew some shit up, including himself.
Yeah. Including himself. Yeah, very true. He put a number on himself to the point that he died.
Yeah.
So he, I guess the there's no official explanation. We'll just throw that out there. But the prevailing theory, what everyone says, is he was messing around with some chemicals, certain volatile chemicals. What the Pasadena Police Department said, or what they concluded, was he had been mixing fulminate of mercury in a coffee can and he dropped it on the floor, causing the explosion. And it got worse when it came into contact with all the other chemicals in the room. So he was handling something, and apparently he had notoriously sweaty hands. This has been said. His buddy Ed Foreman said he had sweaty hands and he could have dropped the can. Like, it's not, you know, beyond reason. But a lot of people also say he was very neat and safety was paramount to him. So it doesn't add up. But either way, an explosion happened. The theory on how the explosion happened, we'll get into here in a second. But as a result of this explosion, he blew off half his face. His skull was exposed. He blew his right arm off. And he lived for a little while. Like,
yeah. Like 30 minutes or something.
Yeah, enough for the ambulance to show up. And he tried to talk to him. And there's some speculation about what his last words possibly were. But he died. He eventually succumbed to his injuries, you know. But they said surrounding him were rocketry papers and pentagrams, occult drawings, and chemical formulae. So all of his favorite stuff.
Yeah.
He died doing what he loved to do. But there's also, they say that there was some, like I mentioned earlier, a syringe of morphine in the room as well. So there's all sorts of speculation of how he could have died. One of them being he was fucked up and then he fucked up and dropped something he shouldn't have dropped.
Well, I wonder if he was conscious and had like such severe injuries. I mean, he blew his own arm off. I wonder if he might have injected the morphine as like a like, oh my God, I've been injured and I have this pain thing. Like, maybe that's what it was there for. I don't know if he was a habitual morphine user or not, but
yeah,
that seems like something kind of smart to have around if you're working with explosive chemicals.
Sure. Absolutely. if you're accident prone with sweaty hands, which I don't know. I guess he wasn't known for, I mean, he was known for blowing shit up, but I don't think he was known for being reckless or, I mean, he obviously didn't. I mean, you can only blow yourself up once, really, if you're lucky. but yeah, he made it all the way up to the upstairs, or by the upstairs. Like he was mobile there for a while, and he tried to talk to the ambulance, the paramedics, and one source says his last words were, "I wasn't done." And another source says that his last words were, "Who will take care of me now?" Yeah. And to make it even more sad, his mother committed suicide by overdosing on sleeping meds within hours of his death.
Yeah.
So she found out that her son had passed and then she took her own life. So it's just all bad. And as with any good death, there's quite a few theories out there. Did you look into any of those?
Mm-mm, not really.
Okay. Well, it's always fun to get into, but of course there's a suicide theory, because, you know, like I said, he just gone through that, you know, everything professionally, personally, and L. Ron Hubbard had just ripped him off. But he did have his, you know, new wife and new life, and he was trying to get his life back.
Trip planned. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, people said that he was, I mean, people that knew him, that he was depressed. He just couldn't shake it. Yeah. And they said he was like on a downward spiral at the time. But to make it more interesting, other people thought that he might have been assassinated by the Los Angeles Police Department, because in, I think it was in the 30s, like late 30s, he was like an expert witness in a trial for a cop that it was a trial for a cop that apparently was trying to blow up some like investigator or something. He was trying to kill someone, this Captain Earl Kinnett, and Parsons went in as the expert explosives witness, and I guess his testimony is what led to the cop being convicted.
Yeah,
so they thought it was revenge. The LAPD wanted him dead, and they did whatever they could to, I mean, however many years later they got him. Yeah, so there's that.
That, you know, sounds very Hollywood.
Yeah, very. But there's also folks who say that the explosion came from underneath the floorboards, which would imply that it was a plot to kill him. So there's also the idea that Howard Hughes had him kill because Parsons was suspected of stealing Hughes Aircraft Company documents at one point. So Howard Hughes had him killed. And the last one that I got, oh, there's a couple. Anti-Zionists opposed his work for Israel, because remember, yeah, he was planning on moving there. Yeah, so he seemed like he was getting pretty deep into that political spectrum there, and they're saying he got killed, and that would seem to be a part of his life at the time, a big part. So maybe, but the last one and most interesting is that he had died in a right designed to create a homunculus.
Cool.
Which is, you know, a fully formed mini human.
But what's the evidence for that? Like,
there's no evidence of any of this stuff, not even that he dropped the chemicals and blew himself up. There's his death is still not definitively explained. I mean, but how can it be when you're alone and you blow up? How can you, you know what I mean? Like, with all the shit he had around, who knows?
I can't believe his mom killed herself within hours. That's so dramatic.
Yeah,
very, I'm sorry. I don't know, sad. The lady. I don't mean to judge her. I obviously don't know jack shit about her, but that seems really, extreme.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else she had going on, you know. I mean, who knows.
I wonder if she, like, to have your kid, your only child, engaging in such a dangerous career, if you kind of always, like, I wonder if she had it plotted out already, like.
Yeah,
I don't know. That's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know, man.
I would like to learn more about Jack Parsons' mom.
Yeah, maybe there's some stuff out there. I really don't know, but it is. I mean, you got a feel for the lady, obviously. Just,
yeah,
you know. But yeah, maybe that was her plan A. If that ever came to fruition, you know.
Yeah,
that's a terrible thing to have to go through. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's the life of Jack Parsons, and death. His legacy is something else. Did you know that there's a theory out there that his whole Babylon working ritual, people say that they suggest that it marked the start of the appearance of UFOs in the skies.
And it, no,
because after that happened in the 40s, that's Roswell happened. And then like all, you know, like the most famous ones, like Roswell from 47. Yeah. And
that's kind of cool.
This one guy, he postulates that the 1952 Washington, D.C. UFO incident was a spiritual reaction to Parsons' death. So not only did Babylon Working create the appearance of flying saucers in the skies, his death has caused UFO sightings.
That's kind of beautiful. I choose to react in awe and appreciation for the timing of those things is kind of, that's cool.
Absolutely. I mean, he had an impact on the world and still does for sure. I mean, I mean, what do you think of his body of work and how it should be perceived? Like, is he like an unsung kind of hero figure, or is it tragic, or is he like a victim of a fucking ignorant, archaic society that just would not accept him? Or like, what do you think his legacy ought to be?
I think it's really hard for it's hard to, even as someone who was, I mean, obviously I'm not anymore. I don't practice Thelemite. I don't identify as a Thelemite. I'm not active in OTO. Haven't been for a long time. It's really hard to understand kind of his legacy and what was important to him, even having shared some of his perspectives, even having done some of the, you know, spiritual practices that he did in a totally different time and with a totally different level of commitment and involvement, you know, he it's hard to it's hard to appreciate without having experienced it oneself, right? You know. I guess it's kind of tragic in the sense that everything that he did and contributed to how we just fucking took some pictures of Mars, like, with you know, there was some technology that he spearheaded, you know, made that possible. And I do think that that's really beautiful and cool, but also, like I said earlier, a scientist doesn't really own their discoveries. They usher them, they shelter them, they give them space to kind of expand and shine a light on it. They do some writing about what they are seeing and share it with others in a way that is impactful. And so I think it's okay to not obsess over him. You know, I don't think we need to be erecting any statues or anything like that.
Right. I think, but maybe not his, kind of write him out of the history, you know, of like, I mean, NASA doesn't really acknowledge him as being very I don't know, crucial in any way.
Yeah.
Like maybe that's a miscarriage of history in his legacy, but at the same time, like they probably just want to distance themselves from a madman.
Yeah.
Which is totally, I'm sure, what their MO is, you know?
Well, maybe NASA is really taking, you know, separation of church and state really seriously. More seriously than other branches of government.
Separation of church and space.
Yeah.
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 I don't know. It just, yeah. It's definitely a tragic figure in the sense that his achievements aren't, I guess, as lauded as his peers. But at the same time, he didn't carry himself that way.
Yeah.
He didn't really seem to care much about stuff like that.
Yeah, which is, that's cool. That's cool to me, you know?
Yeah, he's like,
I think the
definition of cool.
It's kind of similar, like, to Crowley, actually, about how history has kind of held this person in kind of a perpetual space of misunderstanding, but I kind of can appreciate that it's not possible to really understand these people on a deep level because of how complicated and weird their lives were.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And that's okay. There's a piece to that. Crowley didn't start out his life wanting to be a founder of a religion. He viewed himself as a poet and as an author, and kind of similar with Jack Parsons and rocket science, jet propulsion.
Mm-hmm.
His contributions to those things, both of them, their contributions to literature and to rocket science are really important, but they're not as valuable in context of their super crazy fucking lives.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Crowley was a very good writer, by the way. But he wrote a lot and he cared about it a lot, and he felt it was an important part of his life and part of his purpose on earth. But
yeah, well, his words were effective enough. If they weren't, if he wasn't a great writer, they at least had some impact. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's definitely true. You know. Really, really interesting, enigmatic, crazy, hard to learn about, because anything you look up about these people, it's like a 59 minute long video made by a crazy person on YouTube is like the source.
Yeah.
For this information, it's really hard to learn about them in a neutral, meaningful, all-encompassing kind of way.
Yeah. And if anyone does want to learn more about them, or, you know, Parsons in general.
Yeah.
I did just pick up the book Strange Angel by George Pendle, and there's a TV show of the same name for 2 seasons on CBS All Access. It just got canceled, by the way, or last year or something, 2019. I don't fucking know. But there's few books about them a couple that are actually legit, it seems, that do his story justice, but he has his own writings.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are posthumous. Freedom is a
two-edged sword.
Mm-hmm. Something like that. Yeah, that seems to be one of his
collection of essays.
Yeah, he's got, you can look it all up. I'll post a link to his works. But yeah, he's got his own, I mean, he's got philosophical and political writings that kind of didn't see the light of day until after he passed.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a better sense of the man, I guess. I haven't read any of them, but I can only assume it's as wild as I can imagine it to be, you know?
Yeah. And in the context of his, you know, historical, social, political moment is also important to read it from that perspective too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to spend one day, 1 hour in this man's head, I swear, would be, it would change me forever.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, fucking crazy. Well, is there anything else you want to throw in here or get into about old Jack Parsons or Thelema or anything?
I think we did. I feel good about the ground we covered.
I
think, you know, not being experts in any way, we approached this topic with curiosity and interest, and
amen.
I think Jack Parsons would have been proud of that.
Yeah. We grazed that pasture, dropped a few turds, and on to the next one, you know.
I would be really curious to hear of any if any of your listeners have like ideas or disagreements or questions or anything about any of what we talked about. I would love to hear what your listeners know about the subject. And
me too. And let me tell you, I've been at odds with the listeners lately, because I've been calling on them to write me and talk to me, and no one ever writes me. No one ever sends any emails or anything. So,
well, let me try asking instead of it coming from you. I'd really love to know what people thought of this episode, because it's a conversation, and I would love to talk, especially if anyone who's listening who is a Thelemite now, like if I screwed the pooch on anything, or if I said anything in a way that was interesting or cool or wrong. Like, I want to know.
Yeah, I want to know too. So write me, everyone. LostRhetoricPodcast@gmail.com.
Do it.
Oh, before we go though, I should at least say that the International Astronomical Union did name a crater on the far side of the moon after Parsons in 1972.
That's cool.
And JPL eventually credited him for making, quote, distinctive technical innovations that advanced early efforts in rocket engineering.
Wow.
So they're just like, yeah, he was there and he did some cool shit.
They gave him his flowers.
Yeah, that's basically the extent of official acknowledgement of his achievements in life. Yeah. in the professional one.
Yeah, totally.
But cool. Hey man, the guy, like I said, wild man. It's hard. I understand how it's, and unless you are truly like a rock star playing music or making art of some kind, people like him don't get celebrated.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, it's too much for the normals.
Too much. Well, but, you know, excess never, what is it? Moderation never created an explosion.
Yeah, it's.
Did you just have a real crack up, like off the mic?
maybe just a little bit, but it's moderation has never yet engineered an explosion.
Gotcha.
For the third time, let it sink in. That's not to say go out and be an excessive piece of shit, everybody, but
no.
Hey, have some fun.
Have some fun.
All right, Grace, thank you for being here with me. I super appreciate it. I've been looking forward to this one.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Have a good night. Get some rest. I know it's been a long day.
Yes, it has.
All right. Well, I will talk to you soon.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. Bye, Grace.
Bye.
Okay. There it is. There it was. Grace Bigler and I talking Jack Parsons. I kind of had this funny thought earlier today that I didn't bring up during our talk, but I started thinking about the musician Graham Parsons, and I started thinking about some similarities between he and Jack Parsons. And one of them being Graham Parsons, one of his most famous albums is Grievous Angel. And then there's a book and a television show about Jack Parsons called Strange Angel. And there's something about oranges. They have a connection to oranges. Like Graham Parsons' family is a citrus family and they're rich. He comes from money. And Parsons comes from money, but not citrus money. Something about like living on Orange Avenue or some shit. The word orange has something to do with Jack Parsons' upbringing, but whatever, that's a loose one. But they're also both known for mixing things that shouldn't be mixed, or so people thought. Jack Parsons mixing rocket science and occult magic, and Graham Parsons mixing rock and roll and country music. Not supposed to do it, but it worked. Graham Parsons invented alt country, basically. They both died young. I mean, Graham Parsons a lot younger than Jack Parsons. But, I mean, that's a thing. Graham Parsons died in Joshua Tree, which is the desert in California. And Jack Parsons did a lot of experiments in Southern California, Arroyo Seco, in the desert, basically, of Southern California. You know, there's all these hilarious kind of ties between Graham Parsons and Jack Parsons. And I shit you not, while I was thinking of all this stuff, the last thing that came to my mind was that their last name was the same. And I don't know why that was the last thought that I had. And I don't even know, because I started thinking about Grievous Angel and Strange Angel first. And then way later it dawned on me like, oh shit, they have the same last name. And then my mind just exploded. So I had to tell you about that. Even though they're not related at all in any way, shape, or form. There's some funny similarities between the two. But that's it. That was Jack Parsons. Thank you, Grace, for being here. Thank you all for listening as usual. And like I said, write me, lostrhetoricpodcast@gmail.com. Write me about anything, especially about this episode. If you got any thoughts about Parsons or Thelema or Crowley or any of that shit, I would love to hear from you. Follow me on Instagram @LostRhetoricPodcast. Check out the Spotify playlist for this episode, LR037. Check out all the bands I suggested. You won't be disappointed. And that's it. That's it for the week, everybody. Thank you for being here with me. I really appreciate it. I will see you next week. And until then, please, everyone, stay sane and stay safe.